Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 3, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Good afternoon, and welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today's Courthouse Steps conference call is on the case of City of Los Angeles v. Patel and the proper structure of a Fourth Amendment challenge. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome as our expert, Professor Nicholas Quinn Rosenkrantz from Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Rosenkrantz is also on the Federal Society's Board of Directors. More complete bio of our expert was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for Professor Rosenkrantz's presentation, followed by your questions. So without any further ado, Professor Rosenkrantz, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you. So Los Angeles versus Patel, it's a very interesting case. It was argued at the Supreme Court this morning, and I was in the gallery and listened with interest, so I can tell you a bit about the case and give you a bit of my impressions of what happened this morning. So Los Angeles has an ordinance, a city ordinance, which requires hotels to keep certain records about the guests that are staying there. Things like name and address and the number of people in the guest's party, things like the make, model, and license plate of the guest's vehicle, if the car is going to be there. Date and time of arrival, scheduled date of departure, room assigned to the guest, rate charge, et cetera. So Los Angeles requires hotels to keep those records, and nobody argues that there's any problem with that. However, the ordinance goes on to provide that the hoteliers have to show those records to a police officer upon request. So that is to say, no warrant is required, no particular articulable suspicion is required. A police officer can simply walk in and say, show me the guest registry, and the hotel has to do so. And so several hoteliers brought suit complaining that this regime violates the Fourth Amendment, which forbids unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, what's odd about the case, at least in its current posture, is that the hoteliers are contesting the ordinance purely on its face, meaning they're not complaining about any particular search or any particular request. They're not saying, on January 3rd, a police officer came in and demanded these records without any suspicion, and that's our complaint. That violated the Fourth Amendment. Instead, they're saying, in the abstract, in general, we think this regime violates the Fourth Amendment, without describing any particular search or any particular seizure. So there are no facts in the case. It's kind of odd. It's just an abstract challenge to this ordinance. Now, so the court actually granted cert on two questions. The first was the threshold question: is this a properly formatted Fourth Amendment challenge? Can you bring a Fourth Amendment challenge like this that is purely abstract? Can you bring a purely facial Fourth Amendment challenge? So that was the first question on which the court granted cert. And then the second question was, if this is a properly formatted challenge, if you are allowed to bring a challenge like this, then on the merits, does this regime comply with the Fourth Amendment? Is it consistent with the Fourth Amendment or not? So those are the two questions in the case, and I can tell you I actually filed a brief on behalf of the Manhattan Institute on that first issue. So our position was that actually no, you cannot challenge cannot bring a Fourth Amendment challenge in the abstract, a purely facial Fourth Amendment challenge without citing any facts. And we offered a pretty clear reason for that. The court's been very confused about this distinction between facial and as-applied challenges. And so we tried to give the court an opportunity to clarify this distinction. The way we put it is that the distinction between facial and as-applied challenges is simply a distinction based on who exactly you're complaining about, what I call the who question. So if you are actually complaining about legislative action, what a legislature has done, then your challenge is properly a facial challenge. But if you're really complaining about what an executive officer has done, your challenge is an as-applied challenge. Now, if that's so, you then have to look at each clause of the Constitution to see which actor is bound by that clause. And what we say is, well, the Fourth Amendment really binds executive actors because it's executive actors who do the searching and seizing. So on our view, a Fourth Amendment challenge always and inherently must be an as-applied challenge because it has to be complaining about what an executive officer did, a particular search. The executive, you know, the FBI, you know, broke down my door and shined the flashlight in my face. That's the Fourth Amendment violation, not the passing of a law. So that was our argument, that this was not a properly framed challenge, that in fact a Fourth Amendment challenge can never be a purely facial, abstract challenge. The court, though, this morning spent most of its time talking about and asking about the second question, which is to say, I guess, assuming that this is a properly brought challenge, is this regime consistent with the Fourth Amendment? Now, what was interesting about the argument from my perspective is that the argument had a very theoretical flavor to it. It's not unusual for Supreme Court arguments to have a lot of hypotheticals and things, but this had quite an abstract hypothetical flavor to the entire argument, and I think it's for exactly the reason that we set forth in our brief. This case just doesn't lend itself to this kind of analysis because there are no facts. A kind of Fourth Amendment inquiry really usually turns on specific facts. So you have the justices asking, you know, well, what if the register, you know, the guest register was kept at the front desk, or what if it was on a computer screen, or what if it was kept in the back, or what if they kept it in a public space, but then they hid it whenever the police arrived? You had questions about whether this would be the same in a hunting lodge, and what if it was a private hunting lodge or a public hunting lodge? These are all interesting hypothetical questions, and we can see how they get at different aspects of the Fourth Amendment problem, but you know, what was the argument had a kind of unreal flavor to it because there were no underlying facts. Nobody could say, well, in this case, what happened was the register was in the back or whatever, because there were no facts in this case. So I'd say the argument had quite a theoretical flavor to it. Both of the advocates were superb. So we had Tom Goldstein representing the hoteliers, and then challenging the ordinance. And we had Josh Rosenkranz, who is no relation to me, representing the city and trying to defend the ordinance. It was quite interesting. I'd say they both received some difficult questions. I'd say they both were excellent in their handling of the questions. I suspect the case will be 5-4, but I'm not actually sure how it's going to come out. That is, if they were to reach the Fourth Amendment merits, I think it would be 5-4, and I'm not sure how it would turn out. But I remain hopeful, actually, that when the justices actually sit down to write this thing, they will realize that you can't quite do this analysis without a set of facts before you. But this is not a properly framed challenge. So even though the argument was largely about the second Fourth Amendment question, I'm hopeful that the first question is actually going to decide the case and that the court will say this is just not a properly framed challenge. I guess I'll stop there, but I'm happy to take questions about the case itself or my impressions from this morning or whatever you'd like to ask.
All right. So if we can open the floor up to your questions as an audience, in a moment you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. All right, looks like we had our first question jump on the line.
Yes, sir. My name is Mark Gibson. I'm a Federalist Society member out of here in Texas. My question Is it a valid assumption, in your opinion, since hotel record searches are uniformly sort of the same in purpose and character? First off, is that a valid assumption for the purposes of a case like this? And then, if you accept that's a valid assumption, then the effect of challenging the ordinance facially, doesn't that then have the effect of dealing with all of the possible individual challenges as applied challenge? What do you think about that?
That's a great question, but I don't think that a facial challenge necessarily, quote, deals with more than an as-applied challenge, or I don't think it deals with more in an appropriate way. I think in the Fourth Amendment context, what the court is supposed to do is analyze whether a particular search or mm-hmm. seizure was reasonable or unreasonable. I think that mm-hmm. is the Fourth Amendment question, and mm-hmm. so the Fourth Amendment is really binding executive actors not to perform unreasonable searches and seizures, and that's inherently quite a fact-bound inquiry. Now, it may be, and it often is, that when the court does that fact-bound inquiry as to a set of facts before it, it ends up announcing a rule which mm-hmm. would imply that many such searches would be unconstitutional, right? Not just this search, but any search that looks like this search in the relevant way.
And yeah, going at it the other direction.
Yeah. Right, so that mm-hmm. might be a lot of searches. That might actually invalidate, many or most or even all of the searches under a particular ordinance. But nevertheless, the court has to deal with the particular set of facts in front of it, I think. Now, a second piece of your question, I think, was whether there are other similar ordinances and whether all such ordinances are the same.
No, it wasn't similar ordinances. I was asking if you think it's valid to assume that the type of hotel record searches that this case deals with it pertains generally and uniformly to hotels in that situation. In other words, can we assume that when a police officer walks into a hotel and says, "Hey, let me take a look at your books there," that the purpose of his search is going to be generally the same, in many such searches, if not the vast majority of them?
Well, I think the thing is, no, we can't assume that at
okay.
all. So
right. Okay.
So first of all, a police officer might say, "I want to look at your records because they are interested in whether you are keeping proper records."
Mm-hmm.
And the purported purpose of this ordinance is that. Like, theoretically, mm-hmm. each of these searches is supposed to be for that reason, the administrative purpose of making sure you're complying with the requirement of keeping these records.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so some police officers will ask for that reason. Other police officers will ask because they have reason to believe that a fugitive that they are pursuing
right.
is, staying in that hotel and they want to see. Now, a third possibility is the police officer does not like the particular hotelier and wants to harass him. I mean, that is at least a theoretical possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And when you attack the statute on its face, you're capturing all of those cases. So
right, and you answered my question, perfectly, beautifully, because if you cannot make that assumption, then really, how can you deal with it facially?
That's exactly the point.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time, sir.
Thanks for the question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Rosenkranz, press star and then the pound key. One quick programming note for those of you on the line. Our next scheduled teleform conference call is tomorrow on the King versus Burwell case with Professor Jonathan Adler, and that will be at 2 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow. So another Courthouse Steps version of the telephone conference call. While we're waiting, Professor Rosenkranz, just for those of on the line, just to clarify, would this be considered what's called an administrative search?
Well, that's a good question. So that was discussed during the argument. The ordinance it is easier to sustain the ordinance if these searches are characterized as administrative searches. So there's a sort of a line of doctrine which is more permissive of such searches if they are purely administrative searches, as against law enforcement searches. So, you know, law enforcement searches generally require a warrant and probable cause and so forth. Administrative searches, there's a sort of a lesser standards. So now these searches, you know, they have some of the characteristics of an administrative search. After all, it's an administrative regime regulating a pretty highly regulated industry. On the other hand, though, we can certainly imagine that most cops who want to look at the registry are trying to ferret out some crime. So that was very much up for debate in the case.
All right. Well, if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Rosenkranz, press star and then the pound key. We have a particularly quiet audience this afternoon. You guessed that it would be 5-4 if it came out. Would it be? Would your guess be that it would be the traditional 5-4 lineup with Justice Kennedy in the middle, or do you anticipate that it would be a different lineup than that?
Yeah, I think it'd be the 5-4 that you'd expect with. You know, and I wouldn't be sure where Justice Kennedy or maybe the chief would come out. But, you know, it's really hard to say, and I think it's harder to say than usual exactly because this argument had such a kind of theoretical flavor to it. You know, if we don't have any questions on the line, I can just say a little bit more about the facial and as-applied issue. Do we have a question waiting or no?
Don't right now. So that'd be fantastic.
Okay. Sure. So, you know, I can just kind of spell out this theory a little bit more clearly. You know, it's my claim that certain clauses of the Constitution bind certain actors and other clauses bind other actors. And it's essential to figure out which clauses bind which actors. So what I say is you can't figure out whether the Constitution has been violated until you have a theory about who you think violated it. So I start out with the First Amendment, which is happily the clearest one. It's written in the active voice with a clear and single subject. It says, Congress shall make no law. So what I say is, well, we have to take that seriously. That's a clause which binds Congress. If Congress is the answer to the who question, then the answer to the when question must be when Congress made the law. If you're complaining about a First Amendment violation, you must be saying Congress violated the Constitution by making a law on the day that it made a law. But what's interesting about that is on that day when Congress made the law, there were no facts. The thing hasn't been enforced yet. And any facts that might arise after that can't really matter to the constitutional analysis because the Constitution either was violated or wasn't before any facts arose. So I say a First Amendment challenge is properly a facial challenge. In that context, you are complaining about what Congress did when it made a law, and thus your challenge is inherently a challenge to legislative action and thus a facial challenge. You claim that we can see the constitutional violation on the face of the statute just by reading the thing. Now, what I say is the Fourth Amendment, by contrast, works in this other way. Fourth Amendment doesn't say Congress shall make no law. It rather restricts unreasonable searches and seizures, and paradigmatically, those things are done by the executive branch. So in the Fourth Amendment context, it seems to me, you are always inherently complaining about executive action. The answer to the who question is always the executive, and thus the answer to the when question is always when the executive executed the unreasonable search or seizure. Now in this case, we don't have such a thing. No executive officer executed an unreasonable search and seizure, and thus we don't yet have a Fourth Amendment case. Fourth Amendment hasn't yet been violated. It's not violated until the day when someone executes such a search. So that was really the claim of the Manhattan Institute brief, and it was building on two articles that I wrote in the Stanford Law Review, Subjects of the Constitution and Objects of the Constitution. So if you're interested in hearing more about that theory, you might take a look at the MI brief or at those two Stanford Law Review articles. But as I say, the argument wasn't much about this. It was really mostly about the merits of the Fourth Amendment question. I'm happy to talk about either one if we've got anyone on the line who'd like to discuss.
Well, if you'd like to discuss the previously mentioned issues or anything else with Professor Rosenkrantz, press star and then the pound key. It looks like we did have one more question jump on.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. This case seems to raise the whole issue pre-Frothingham that all members of the public have a right to privately prosecute a public right, as opposed to the cases and controversy doctrine, which I consider to be false, that someone had to have been personally injured. Do you think that this case might enable us to push back to the original concept as envisioned by the founders, that any individual would be able to prosecute a public right in court, even if he had not been injured?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I agree with your characterization of the founding view on this. But just to be clear, my point is not an Article 3 point. So I'm not making really a claim about standing or anything like that or who gets to vindicate whose rights. My claim is really that if we take the language of the Fourth Amendment seriously, no one's right has been violated yet. The Fourth Amendment forbids unreasonable searches and seizures, not ordinances which may authorize such things. So LA may have enacted an ordinance which could potentially authorize a Fourth Amendment violation. But as far as we know, no actual Fourth Amendment violation has occurred yet. And that's really the problem with the suit from my perspective, not that the wrong party is vindicating the wrong person's rights, but that actually no one's rights have been violated yet, at least as this case is framed.
All right. Well, we have one more question pending, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, please press star and then the pound key.
Oh, hi, this is Dave Hickman. I'm out in the Seattle area, and I just have a practical question. Any thoughts on why the plaintiffs would go to the time and expense of prosecuting a case all the way to the Supreme Court on this issue?
You mean without a set of facts? Is that what you mean?
Like, yeah, like, I'm not.
Spatial posture.
I see how the hoteliers are really being harmed here, and this is a fairly expensive proposition. I'm somewhat puzzled why they would take it this far.
Well, it is quite puzzling. I'm a little vague about this myself, but as I understand it, there was an as-applied challenge in this case at an early phase, and there was some sort of agreement that that they wouldn't pursue that, so that it was dropped without prejudice, and they have the option to revive it later. But as I understand it, the parties somehow agreed, stipulated that I don't know, that this was somehow a cleaner, faster case as a facial challenge, and so they decided to just proceed with the facial challenge. I guess Los Angeles conceded that all of its defenses were essentially facial defenses, and so the hoteliers were content to proceed with a purely facial challenge. I guess it didn't occur to anyone at that stage, at the trial stage, that might present a kind of structural problem with the case. But so we've ended up, just by this odd quirk, we've ended up with a kind of a strange Fourth Amendment case at the Supreme Court just because of the way the parties have framed the thing. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure if they had it to do over, they wish that their as-applied challenge was still, you know, was before the court as well, but it isn't. So we have a kind of an odd case here, which is a purely facial Fourth Amendment case just for this quirky reason.
All right, well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. All right, we have one more question that jumped on.
Uh, Professor, just a quick question. You mentioned that this case comes against a backdrop of sort of a tangle in the law as to what facial and as-applied challenges really mean. Could you speak to that a little bit, that backdrop?
Yes. So the court has the intuition that there are two different flavors of judicial review. And they have the intuition that one of them is somehow more narrow and fact-bound and implicating just the facts of a particular case, and that the other flavor is somehow broader and more abstract and theoretical, and that it's really somehow an attack on a statute as a whole or an ordinance as a whole, the suggestion that the thing is somehow rotten to the core, and the suggestion that the remedy, the proper remedy, may be to throw the thing out altogether. So they have this intuition that there are these two different flavors, and they've called these two different flavors facial challenges for the broader, more theoretical ones, as applied challenge for the more narrow, fact-bound ones. But other than that, the court has been very vague about quite what these two flavors mean, quite when it's appropriate to bring the one and when the other, quite what the standard is for success in the one case versus the other, quite what the remedy will be if you succeed in one or the other. The court's been really quite vague on all of this. I mean, I would say they really don't have a good theory. They have suggested that they far prefer as applied challenges to facial challenges, that they prefer that as the normal, I think they've called it the normal building block of adjudication. But nevertheless, they sometimes allow these broader, more theoretical facial challenges, but they've been quite vague about why and when and what the standard is. They've spelled out that a facial challenge, in a case called Salerno, they said a facial challenge has to be one where there's no possible set of circumstances under which the statute could be constitutionally applied. But then in other cases, they seem to ignore that standard and allow a facial challenge without using that formulation. So they've been quite vague about this. They have the intuition that there are these two flavors, but they've been quite vague about when, about which is which and why. And I have offered them a theory about this distinction, which is the very simple fundamental theory that the difference between these two flavors is simply the difference between challenging legislative action and challenging executive action. I claim that just turning your attention to the who question makes this distinction crystal clear. The court often talks in vague terms about challenges to statutes. And I say that's not quite right. A statute can't violate the Constitution any more than a gun can commit murder. The proper thing to say is that some actor has violated the Constitution, and generally either a legislature like Congress or an executive branch like an FBI agent, an executive officer. And it's crucial to figure out which. Are you complaining about legislative action or are you complaining about executive action? To me, that answers this facial as applied conundrum that the court's really been struggling with.
All right. Well, we actually had three more questions jump on the line, so we will go right to our first one now. Oh, well, one dropped off, so we have two more.
Hello. My name is David Falstad. I'm calling from Florida. And somebody had asked earlier about what the motivation was for continuing this case and pursuing it. I wondered, is it possibly being driven by attorney's fees? Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I don't know about that. No, I wouldn't say that it's likely to have been driven by that. I think it's really just a kind of a quirk of the way this case was litigated in the lower courts, and that was, you know, I believe before the two appellate lawyers were involved. So I think it's just a quirk of the way this was litigated below. But, you know, it's quite a real case. I mean, I understand why Los Angeles would want to litigate this, and I understand why the hoteliers would want to litigate it. I mean, it matters to both sides in a, you know, quite a legitimate way. So, you know, I'm not surprised that they're fighting it out. I'm just surprised that they kind of accidentally dropped the key part of it out of the district court case, which was the as-applied part of it.
All right. Well, we have one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. And we do have plenty of time left. So if you'd like to ask another question, press star and then the pound key.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It would seem, however, in this case, that hoteliers would have a claim of injury because the knowledge that they were collecting this information for that purpose might chill their clients from using their services and thereby hurt them in their business. However, I also see here, despite the Kurtz depredation of writs of quo warranto, a return to the original principle, the essence, if not the language, that officials may be challenged to prove their authority, and if they can't be prove their authority, to have it stripped from them. And the hoteliers would seem to be seeking to have the authority of the Los Angeles stripped from it for, in this case, exceeding its authority by requiring this kind of proactive investigation power.
Well, so just to be clear, the hoteliers are not contesting the part of the ordinance that requires them to keep these records. So they agree that it is fine. Los Angeles can require them to keep these records. And so to the extent that any hotel guest is chilled by the fact that these records are being kept, that's all permissible chill because the hoteliers concede that's fine. They can do that. So the question here is just whether is this other part of the ordinance, whether a police officer can walk in and look at the records upon request. And that's the part which they're contesting, but that's also the part which hasn't happened yet, or at least hasn't happened yet for purposes of this case, because it's presented as a purely facial challenge. I believe it has, in fact, happened on the ground in Los Angeles. It's just that's not part of our case, oddly. So for our purposes, it hasn't happened. They've been required to keep these records, but nobody has, you know, walked in, or at least they're not alleging a particular set of facts about a police officer walking in and asking for the records. That's the odd quirk of the case. So again, I think this doesn't quite implicate this business of who is gets to defend whose rights. This is a matter of no one's rights has been violated yet, at least as this case is structured.
All right, well, our lines are open, and we do still have time remaining, so if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Well, Professor, while we're waiting to see if there are any other final questions, are there any other issues that you may have touched on briefly earlier that you'd like to elaborate on, or any other thoughts?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, we've ended up talking largely about facial and as-applied challenges because that's the part of the case that has interested me the most, and it's the part on which I filed a brief. I just want to emphasize the court didn't talk that much about that this morning. So they were really on to the merits, which, frankly, I'm less of an expert on, not because I'm not quite a Fourth Amendment scholar. But the court was on to the question of, is the hotel industry a closely regulated industry? That seems to be a standard that was set out in one of the cases, or pervasively regulated industry, excuse me. Thus is there a decreased expectation of privacy? Do the hoteliers have a decreased expectation of privacy in these sorts of records? So that gives you a flavor of what the Fourth Amendment conversation was about. And of course, they were pressing on that with various hypotheticals. What if this were a different kind of industry? What if it were a hunting lodge, et cetera, to try to get at how broad would a Fourth Amendment ruling have to be? If the court says this is fine, does it mean that a search of any such industry would be fine? Would this rule be permissible if it were applied to, you know, any industry you can think of? Or are hotels somehow special? And so there was some talk about the the history of hotel regulation, and that Los Angeles has had some sort of ordinance like this on the books for 100-plus years. And so there was a lot of discussion of that. If we decide this on the merits, quite how far does our ruling have to go? Can it be just about hotels, or would we be implicitly saying these searches are permissible for every industry? And so that gives you a little bit of a flavor of what was discussed today. But as I say, the discussion of it really had quite a theoretical, abstract flavor because, again, the court had no facts in front of it.
All right. Well, it looks like we've exhausted the questions. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank our expert, Professor Rosenkranz, for attending the argument and being with us today to give his presentation and answer your questions. Thank you also to our audience. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. I do want to remind you again that we continue a great week of excitement at the Supreme Court with our teleforum, our Courthouse Steps teleforum tomorrow at 2 p.m. on King versus Burwell with Obamacare back at the Supreme Court. So again, that's at 2 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow with Professor Jonathan Adler. So until then, we're adjourned. And also a reminder that you can find the podcast of this teleforum conference call along with all of our previous calls at our website, fedsoc.org. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.